Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download the club's iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. I'm Stacey Donahue, the leader of Omidyar Network's Governance and Citizen Engagement Initiative in the U.S. and your moderator for tonight's program. Today's program is being held in association with the National Democratic Institute and the Institute for Representative Government, and is part of an exchange program supported by the U.S. State Department and the U.S. Agency for Development. And now on to the program. Today, you will meet some diverse lawmakers from around the world. They are members of Parliament who are confronting the challenges and opportunities presented by new technologies to strengthen engagement between citizens and their elected representatives, and to further democracy in their countries. We'll specifically address how women and young politicians are using technology to promote deliberation and compromise and more inclusive political leadership rather than political polarization. I would like to recognize that in addition to our panelists, we also have with us in the audience 16 members of Parliament from 11 countries. We thank these distinguished guests for being with us tonight. And it's now my pleasure to introduce our panelists. The Honorable Tinatin Tina Kidashili is a member of the Parliament of Georgia. Elected in 2012, she is a member of Georgia's Republican Party, which forms part of the governing Dream Coalition. She serves as chair of the EU-Georgia Parliamentary Cooperation Commission. She has 20 years of human rights experience working as a leader of the largest human rights NGO in the region. The Honorable Emmanuel Kwasi Bezra is a member of Ghana's parliament. He represents the Ho West constituency of the Volta region of Ghana, having been elected in 2008. He serves as chair of the Government Assurances Committee of Parliament and is also a member of the House Committee and the Select Committee on Water, Resources, Works, and Housing. He's a steering committee member of the National Open Government Partnership. The Honorable Gordana Čomić is a member of the Serbian National Assembly. Elected in 2000, she served as the Deputy Speaker from 2001 to 2008 and from 2012 to 2014. She has also served as Chairperson of the Foreign Affairs Committee, Member and Deputy Chairperson of the Environmental Protection Committee, and Member of the Serbian Assembly's European Integration Committee. And finally, the Honorable Sabrine Gubantini is a member of the Tunisian Assembly of People's Representatives. She is a member of the National Founding Board of Nida Tunis, a progressive political party founded in June 2012. She's also a trainer in the party's political academy. And prior to her public service, she was an outspoken political activist and is also a chartered accountant. Please welcome all of our panelists. So to kick off the conversation this evening, just a few thoughts on technology. So I think we're all aware that technology is changing the ways in which politics and the operations of government are conducted. Social media is empowering citizens in new ways, and particularly as access to technology broadens with the ever-decreasing cost and expanding reach of mobile technology. As many of us have heard, Facebook now has 1.4 billion monthly active users globally and is experiencing very rapid growth outside the U.S., as is Twitter. SMS texting is fairly ubiquitous, and other messaging applications like WhatsApp are growing like wildfire. At the same time, technology access and usage trends vary greatly not only by country, but also by socioeconomic level, by gender, by age, and by class. So in that context, each of you has entered politics during this time of incredible, rapid technological change. So my first question for all of you is, what motivated you to get into politics originally? Tina?
Thank you very much. Thank you for everybody for being here and in being interested in hearing what we have to say. As it was said, I'm from Georgia, and I was born in Soviet Union. It was 1992, actually, when I've kind of entered the public life, not the politics per se, but became publicly active. By pure accident, I was going to my father's house, raised by a single mom, time to time visiting my dad. I was going to his house, and there was a little demonstration by the students. I was 19 years old, and I've just got interested in what was going on, and I was shot. This is how it all started. As I was a student at that time of the law school, and I majored in human rights law from the Tbilisi State University, which was the only university at that time in my country. Then I came to this country for studying the law, and this is how my life has been defined, from one demonstration to another, fighting one dictator after another, one system after another. But I never was a member of any political party or in any ways politically involved. However, being a human rights activist in a country like mine, by definition, means that you are influencing politics and you are doing something very close and very much about the politics. As a human rights lawyer, my major work was about the torture, police brutality, fraud during the elections. These were kinds of cases I was going to the courts. And then there was a time when I kind of was losing the profession because of the stage and situation in Georgia and judiciary. So that's when I've joined the political party, and I've got an idea that there was something else to be done in order to change the system rather than just standing in a courtroom and waiting for the decision of the prosecutor in the courtroom how my case will be dealt regardless of what I had to say or what my client had to say. I'm a member of the Republican Party, as it was said, how as strange as it might sound. It's a sister party of your Democratic Party. The name was because of the Republic. The party was created during the Soviet times, underground, and the whole idea was having an independent republic. This is why the founders of the party chose the name as a Republican Party. It's a liberal party, and it stands for everything today's liberalism is about. All the challenges are there, all the problems are there, and we are trying to fight them and to address them. Because we are here in this wonderful program to be introduced to even more advanced stage of technological revolution that is going on here in Silicon Valley and all around the world, and it's a big challenge for all of us from that generation, when we were raised without computers and without the smartphones, and phones still have cords. My 8-year-old son asked me last year, we had a renovation at house, and we found an old phone which had a cord, and he looked at me and he was like, why do you have doglishes on the phones? So that's the difference between the generations we have, and obviously the one of the issues that we are supposed to be talking today is how the technology is influencing our daily lives as of the politicians, how it's influencing our democracies, what role it is playing in each of our countries. And I will just say a couple of words about that. We are using as much as we can, obviously, the technologies. It made our life easier, quicker, cheaper as well. You don't need to hire hundreds of volunteers to go door by door every day while you have it for granted that thousands and thousands are following you and can read a message that you have to tell them. One of the most positive aspects of this technological revolution or social media, I found myself personally as a politician, is that I don't depend on journalists anymore. loving and respecting them. Still, it's now about me, whatever message I have, whatever is it that I want to tell to the people, I want to communicate with my voters. I don't wait for anybody to come and ask me a question, and then for the TV producers, whether they will like my question or my answer or not, and they will have it on air or not. So that gave a completely different perspective, obviously, to our political life. At the same time, it is very practical and also very transparent and open, because now our voters can track us down everywhere. Yesterday, I was on a panel at the Institute for Future in Palo Alto, and NDI had a post on Twitter, and one of the Georgian journalists got it immediately, and it got on the media, like, without me ever intervening in that. And that's also good and perfect about these technologies, because you can be out there and they can watch after you, what you are doing, what you are saying, what is it that they're interested in. But at the same time, obviously, it has its side effects as well. And here I will finish with just one big question, and we will follow up probably during the discussion, that this whole openness and the transparency and participation and a big, great involvement on social media, does it undermine the whole idea of representative democracy or not? Whether those people who are there, out there, posting, asking questions, challenging you, representing general idea of the society, represents the problems within the society, or it's just one group of the activists who are active on Facebook, for example, or on Twitter, and they kind of make their stories, and then we are challenged by those stories, and we kind of forget what is going on in the real world. This is a challenge that I'm fighting with on a daily basis, and I'll finish here, and then we will have more questions, I believe.
Thank you, Stacey. Good evening, everybody. My name is Emmanuel Bezra from Ghana. Let me use this opportunity to thank NDI, the State Department, and of course the Commonwealth Club that has invited us here this evening. I must say there are two events that has shaped my technological life in politics. The first one has to do with my constituent, the youth in my constituency. They came together one day and formed a club called the Whole West Youth Parliament, and formed the club through the use of WhatsApp, and started tweeting and WhatsApping me from the association to find out what I'm doing in Parliament, the roads network in our constituency, the water problem. And I find it very strange, because even though I'm a young person, I've not expected young folks to come together and form an association through the use of mobile technology or social media. And so I went to them, had a meeting with them. Initially, they were 13, but now it's grown up to about 200. They meet, discuss it on the social media, and whatever decision they've taken, they send it to me, and I go through it. The ones that I can answer, I do it. The second one has to do with international dimension. 2013, we met at the OGP conference in London, and alongside, NDI organized a legislative openness working group to deliberate on how we can open parliament. And I noticed that my colleagues from the Southern America side had a lot to do with social media and technology. And it's like, wow, what's going on in this world? If you want to talk about parliament, you open up parliament, transparency, everything about the legislature is put out there. So I asked myself, why don't I go into this and start conversation with my parliament? So I came back, you know, from London conference, and decided that I also open up my own space. It was difficult because, you know, having old folks who do not understand technology, to break that barrier was a difficult situation. So I decided to use my own committee as a basis, and we'll tell you about the story later on. These are the two issues or two events that shaped my political, especially technological life in politics.
I'm in politics by accident. My formal education is I'm a physics, and at the beginning of the 90s, it looked like that me and physics will spend life together. But there were dictatorship in Serbia, there were wars, there were sanctions, there were refugees, there were atrocities, war crimes. And at the beginning of the 90s, I met a politician. His name was Zoran Đinđić. He was the president-to-be of the party that I am now deputy president. He was assassinated in 2003 in Belgrade. And I met him in Novi Sad, in the city I live, north of part of Serbia, and listened to the guy. And I saw a man loving other people, showing very clearly that politics is all about people. And being aware that there is a huge hard time for our society in the years to come, we had a conversation. I had a few questions, and he said, why wouldn't you join the party? I said, I've never been in the party. I've been student activist and a kind of human rights activist, women's rights, environment, but party, you know, it's party. And I joined the party. And I'm blessed with party activism. And what moved me throughout the years of dictatorship, when most of the political work was on the street protesting, either you are arrested or someone you love or know is arrested, so you're trying to get him or her out of the jail, protesting for the basic rights that a lot of societies around the world take for granted. I was fully aware that actually it doesn't matter. Do you join politics in the hard times of dictatorships in your society or here in California as a young woman? You are joining politics because you want to change something. And there is nothing yet better invented than political party and civic society, and you can make up your mind. And I tried to merge both of it because I was very much involved in women's rights. For me, the role of the women in society, whether it's emerging democracies or established democracies like United States is, or Great Britain or European countries, is that we women live in politics, in society, in the framework that men are rule makers and we are rule takers. And that's how it has been for a few thousand years. And we don't like it anymore. So part of the political fight is to establish a dialogue among men and women within political party, within society, of changing that basic rules that worked for men mostly, that I am to just take the rule that someone else make. And that's the politics is all about. That's what I learned from Zoran Đinđić, that politics is all about people and about the rules. And if you want to really be a leader, then you have to learn the rules that are there in real space. You have to implement the rules and then change the rules. And that's more or less name of the game of my fellow women activists. Some of them are sitting right here in the room. And I will add something what we accomplished connected with the technology. These are my friends, Donika from Kosovo and my friend Dubravka from Serbia. We women from Kosovo and Serbia started dialogue several years ago when no man entered and no man foot ever stepped. And that's establishing dialogue between two societies who were in conflict, full of hatred, inherited atrocities, state crimes, you name it, we had it. Why we participated in the dialogue? Because we wanted to show that there is always a choice in politics. You can be stuck up in the past, debating on who did what to whom and why. Or you can start a future-oriented dialogue for the both societies. And that's what we women parliamentarians from Kosovo and Serbia done. And it ended with the support of OSCE back home in the region, And we made a movie about it, a 20-minute movie that will be released, where there you will hear women parliamentarians like us sitting around this table, talking their personal stories, talking about difficulties and barriers to get in touch, to stay in touch, despite of all the men within Serbia and Kosovo who said, we don't talk with them, we hate them. You can hate them, but you can talk with them. And that's the basic rule that women can introduce in politics. That's the basic rules that should be in societies that share the space, but we do not share the epoch. And that's something what I've learned working as an opposition in dictatorship during the 90s and working in institutions since year 2000. Why technology is good? Because I can steal knowledge. Because I can shorten the time of my epoch. I can speed up the processes in my society, once upon a time being a pure revenge society, and transfer it to the rule of law society. That's tremendous effort for a society. And knowing that there is someone there on the internet, knowing that there will be a movie where Donika and I and Dubravka are telling our stories, gives me a great pleasure. Not because of the achievements that we shared in politics, but because of the hope that someone will see that movie. Someone who does not want to talk to someone else. And that someone will say, look at those women from Kosovo and Serbia. They've done it. Maybe I can do it. And that's the whole point of the famous women in politics, yes, we can do it. Thank you.
Well, as my colleague said, I was also a political accident. My use with IT was close before I've started my life in politics. I'm one of those you call the digital natives. So I'm born in 1987. I'm 27 years old. And I started using ITs with ICQ. I think you remember all those tools. MSN. And then I used forums. And then I discovered Facebook, Skype, Twitter, etc. So I'm quite familiar with ITs, and let's say that I've started my activist life, not political life, with writing in blogs and blogging. I was blogging especially not against the previous regime in Tunisia, but for freedom of expression and against censorship. And what really shocked me is that sometimes we were talking in forums and blogs about, let's say, normal topics, and we were censored. And we were followed by the regime. So this made me a little bit, let's say, septic. And I've decided to join the Students' Union in my university. And the problem is that it was prohibited in my university because it was only 15 meters from the presidential palace. So I decided to found this, let's say, local office of a students' union in my university, and I did it. And fortunately, before the regime caught me, the revolution began. So the university is closed. And on December 17th, 2010, I have seen hundreds of hashtags called Sidi Bouzid, which is a town. And those hashtags were reporting the story of a young man who set himself in fire, Mohamed Bouazizi. I'm sure you already heard about him. And we started as Tunisians using those tools, Facebook and internet, mainly Facebook, to organize public protestations in the streets. And in January 2011, in the 14th exactly, the political class that time was really shocked by this effect of social media on the political change. So they started to follow. Well, I'm saying they because I wasn't a politician at that time. I joined after a while. I will be telling the story. So they started using Facebook as a tool to organize protests, and it quite worked. And at that time, I was thinking that I will be, for my whole life, a syndicalist, and that I will never join this, you know, this creepy world of politics and those people who are lying on TVs and on TV shows and debates. I am young. I am a protester. I just can't be, you know, under this system and this regime. But once we had a movie in Tunis. It was 3 months after the revolution. We had a movie that was shown in a very famous cinema in the capital. And we had, let's say, hundreds of extremists who came to the cinema and who blocked the access to public, and they just didn't let them enter to see the movie because it was against the religion. So this was the big change in my life. So I figured out that there is something. Okay, there is a revolution. It's okay. We have freedom of expression. We have abolished the regime, but we have another threat concerning our rights, especially as women. And if we will allow this kind of extremist behaviors, so who knows about our future? So I started being, let's say, active in politics. I opened Facebook. I opened the political programs because we had elections in 3 months after this event. And I started reading programs, and I said, well, I will join the party that will suit me just for the political campaign, and after then, I will come back as a syndicalist. Okay, so I joined a party which was the oldest party in Tunisia, but the smallest one in its number of members. It was the ex-communist party, but it became a social democratic party named the Tajdid. And I participated in the political campaign, and I was shocked by the result. So, yeah, since we were a very small party, as all the progressive and secular parties in Tunisia, we lost the elections, naturally. And after this great result, let's say, because it was, well, a very great defeat, I started thinking about leaving politics as usual. and then the ex-prime minister, which is the actual president of Tunisia, decided to create a party, a new big secular party, to reassemble all the opposition, so the secular tendencies, in order to, as he says, imbalance the political scene. And it was quite difficult at the beginning. It was only an utopic idea because we had lots of efforts and conventions between the different political parties from the same tendency in order to do big coalition, and they all failed. But this guy really believed in this, and few of people believed at the beginning. So I was one of the founders. I was at that time the youngest founder, and 24 years old. And we started setting up the party in all the regions. So I figured out that even if the Tunisian median age was, and still, 30 years old, and even if you find 70% of those young people on Facebook, it is really difficult to reach them. So when you go to coffee shops, when you find the most unemployed young people there, they won't be available to talk about politics. Same thing with women also. they won't be available in markets or in front of the schools waiting for their children to talk about politics. And as a new party, which was also ambitious, we wanted to reach those people. So we started using the social media. And we were not innovative because all the political parties in the political landscape were using these tools. And we started creating Facebook pages for all our offices in all the regional level, really local level, and also the national level. And as all the leaders were doing, and the biggest challenges that we faced were the writing of the constitution, especially in women's rights issue. So we have organized very big protests on the streets. I wish I had the photos, but well, unfortunately, I did not brought my laptop. But we organized protests that reached 200,000 of people in the streets, especially women, for women's rights and for the writing of women's rights in the constitution. And we succeeded also by those protests in organizing a dialogue between our party, which was the biggest party in the opposition, and the ex-ruling party, which was the biggest party at that time, and the Islamist party. We stand up against those first terrorist attacks that were coming to Tunisia after the revolution, and against the political assassinates. And after this, we ran also our campaign by social media by posting our photos and videos on our personal profiles. Right now in the parliament, we are also trying to use this kind of tools, and I was part of the committee of rules of procedures. So we are right now publishing each event and each vote and each information on our website and our Facebook page. I think that as an opportunity, this kind of tools can be very effective in order to, let's say, to build those bridges between citizens and between us as elected representatives. But the main question remains, if we have, as I said, 70% of young people who are on Facebook, why do they do not participate in elections? Why do they still remain 2% in political parties? And why do they still remain 5% in civil society as active members? In 2011, we had only 7% of young people who participated. And the numbers are still low in 2014, in the past elections. So I think that as politicians, we are still using those same 20th century communication techniques with using the tools of the 21st century. And maybe we have to do this kind of update and to look for a way, because we are the only responsible if we couldn't attract those voters and this category of voters. And also the biggest challenge is that even if we are right now the ruling party and we are conducting a war against terrorism and the fight against terrorism, why are we the first exportator, between parentheses, of terrorists in ISIS? Why do we have 3,000 people there who are fighting for, let's say, radical thoughts and radical ideologies? So these kind of challenges remain for our country and for our elected assembly, as we don't know how to keep pace of this up-growing and this spreading technology. I think that, if we have enough goodwill, we'll fight all these challenges. And inshallah, we will do it. And thank you.
Sabrine, you raised some really interesting questions. I also have questions, and so does the audience. But first, for our radio listeners, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We are pleased to have lawmakers from around the world who are discussing how they use technology and social media to enhance democratic participation by their constituents. Our panelists are the Honorable Tina Teen Kidashili, member of the Parliament of Georgia, the Honorable Emmanuel Kwasi Bezra, member of Ghana's Parliament, the Honorable Gordana Chomic, member of the Serbian National Assembly, and the Honorable Sabrine Gubantini, member of the Tunisian Assembly of People's Representatives. I'm Stacey Donahue, leader of Omidyar Network's Governance and Citizen Engagement Initiative in the U.S., and your moderator for tonight's program. You can also find video of the Commonwealth Club programs online at the club's YouTube channel. So now for the questions. So I was really struck by the ways in which you each described how technology has intersected your political lives. You've each gone through a period of political evolution and or revolution in your countries in the past 20 to 25 years, and in some cases quite recently. What do you think of the potential for technology to be used as part of politics and governing as opposed to protest? There have been some people who've said that social media is very good for inciting protest and for changing governments, but not as good at keeping governments and making them work. So I wondered if any of you had thoughts on that. And perhaps, Tina, you could start because you raised the very interesting question about transparency direct democracy government, and are those two things in opposition?
Absolutely. I think that it's exactly the question that we are all struggling with today in today's world. How to use something that is already there for good. How to use it for advancing democracy, for advancing participation, representation, for having as much use of those brains creating those technologies as possible. I think it is, yes, there are very simple ways, and that's what our 2 weeks program was all about, telling us different companies talking to us about different technologies they have developed in order to make our life easier and voters' lives easier in communication with their representatives. Mobilization is part of the game, obviously. Whether you mobilize people for protests or you mobilize them for democracy, for decision making, for the agenda each of the legislator has, that's similar. That's exactly the same. You probably use exactly the same ways. It's just the cost is different. Every time there is an issue which raises differences within the society, if before you had people protesting on the streets, now majority of the society found a comfortable position for themselves. They can sit back, never move in from their armchairs, and post from there whatever their feelings are. And yeah, it has made everybody's life easier and more comfortable, let's put it this way, except for us, obviously. We need to follow every single of those thousands of tweets or Facebook posts that we are getting on the issues. But at the same time, as I've said before, obviously there is a challenge and there is a problem. I was just telling to somebody before that especially with the representatives from districts, when you have this kind of a system as you have in the United States or we have in my country. I have an active Facebook page for the domestic use, Twitter page more for international use. And I'm trying to catch up with everybody who is writing whatever they're writing to me on my Facebook page. I can claim that I do 90% responses. And it is like almost no sleep, because during the day I cannot do that. I do it normally at night time. But at the same time, I always struggle with this question whether the people who are posting on my webpage are actually my voters. My voters not of my party or the political coalition that I represent, but my voters from the district that I represent, because different from the United States, in our case, technology is not that developed to track down the voters by GPS or other similar technologies. So yes, it's important to respond to every citizen of your country, but at the same time, obviously, our interest is to concentrate more on our voters, to respond to their needs, their challenges, their problems, rather than talking about the general issues. And just on top of it, the issue that I've said before is that we need to develop this whole approach in a way that we don't talk to the same group all the time, over and over again, who are most active on those social networks and challenging you on whatever you have to say. But again, at the same time, I think it is great for democracy what is happening in today's world, because politicians are becoming more honest, the politics is becoming more personal. People can come and talk to you directly through the social media, while before we were sitting in their TV screens, in these boxes, and you were basically talking to them, but never heard from them. Now you are basically part of their kitchen talks. Mm-hmm. They can post from their kitchens whatever their feelings are, they are thinking, whatever they have to say. They just go on your page and talk to you. I think this is very important. This is crucial for making it. Many people say that the social media and technology made life more impersonal, but I think it's exactly the opposite way when we deal with the issues that we are talking here today between the politicians and their constituents. It is becoming more personal and more honest than it was before.
Yeah, let me just add to it that representation, the concept of representing people, is just basically to, as it were, to represent them, not because you are better than them, and also to engage them, solicit information and data from them. Therefore, if you go out there and you don't engage with them through whatever means, in the past it used to be town hall meetings, meeting with them one-on-one. But currently, technology has advanced to the stage that you can engage as many people through the social media, through all kinds of technology. That alone gives them feedback as to what you are doing. So I believe that instead of engaging them, using them to demonstrate, or engaging them, using those who have elected you to do other things, it is better to engage them, give them feedback as to what you are doing. Communication is very important. If you don't do that, the next thing is that the people will be against the regime that is not communicating with its people, that is not engaging them. Then it means that you are not representing them enough. So I believed that technology, as we have now, we can use it to the benefit of society and to politicians as well.
The first internet page, as you may know, was from CERN, and I knew what was written there. It's all about information and people gathering around some space. The internet, the tools, the new technologies, for us politicians, it's agora of 21st century. And potentially, it's a great tool for me as a regulator, but even greater for citizens, because there is a place that your voice can be heard. And politicians who don't want to listen do not deserve nice treatment, not on the elections, but all of the time. And the point, the sentence that I remember whenever I have to resolve something, how to use it for the benefit, whatever it may be, software, add-ons, whatever, it's about voices heard. And there is something deeply feminine in that. Because we, the women, we didn't have voice for quite a long, long period of time. And all of a sudden, there is Web 2.0, where your voice can be heard, accessible. Access matters, and what will be shared in that agora? It's not up to the tool, it's up to us people. So whatever happens in reality will happen in virtual space. There is no sentence what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. What happens on internet stays on internet forever. You can't delete anything. But you can be the part of it. You can you can stay the part of it, and you can learn faster, you can learn more, you can share more knowledge, more than ever in human civilization. I shared with my colleague a joke, anecdote. My last kid, I have four kids, two boys, two girls, gender balanced. She was 16, and she asked me, "Mommy, how have you dated without texting and mobile phones?" I said, "We managed someone, you are the proof." And that's also the message for the internet. He or she who was born after the CERN, the Institute of CERN, posted the first internet page ever, she or he can't imagine that there was a world without internet, a world without our technologies. But we don't have a dialogue about it. And that's for me the space that I enjoy very much from the very, very first ZX Spectrum 41. I am geeky and nerdy person and physicist, and I don't know nothing about politics. But I know that if there is a space for people to connect, they will connect. If they connect, they will regulate their relations. If they regulate, then they are on our side, and the regulation are held upon this side. So without the internet, we don't hear each other often enough. With the internet, I think that we can improve everything.
Okay, so, my main problem actually with this question is that I'm used to be an opponent, and I'm just getting used to be in a ruling party, you know. So I'm a little bit, very familiar with this kind of protesting, using internet in protesting. And this was always my question during this past few months. How can we canalize these protestative movements into something constructive, and how can we, calm these protestations? So our main problem, as I said, in Tunisia is that most of the internet users are young people. They are under 35 years old, and those young people represent 65% of the population. But the problem is that they are not participating. And even worse, they are using Facebook and other tools, other IT tools, in spreading the word to boycott elections and boycott political parties and all that stuff. I think that we don't have to complicate things. I'm a young girl, I'm a young Tunisian girl, and I'm quite close to all those young people, and I know their concerns and their thoughts. Sometimes, unfortunately, politicians think that they want something really special, but those people want only jobs and dignity and freedom, and that's all. So if, as political parties and as governments, can find the word, the right words, not the very formal phrases and paragraphs and other stuff, the right words to talk using the IT tools to those people, I think this change will happen, and maybe we'll be able to canalize these protestative movements. For women, the question is quite different, because women in Tunisia are very engaged, and Tunisian women in the MENA region have been known by their emancipation and by their leadership in women's rights. So we really take profit from using technologies in being active and being constructive. And most of those petitions online signers are Tunisian women. And they are really very active in writing articles, in doing counterattack campaigns when it comes to terrorism, radicalism, and all that stuff. So this is really great what we are living with the Tunisian women. I will come back a little bit to young people. And I will just say that maybe with our new parliament, which contains only 25 members under 40 years old, will be doing something great for those 75% or 65% of population who are waiting only for dignity, freedom, and jobs. And with the goodwill, I always insist on the goodwill and the good faith, we can really change something. And I'm really optimistic in this side. So thank you.
So we talked about women and the activism of women right before we started this panel. And I mentioned, well, what about the technology gender gap? And three of the four of you said there isn't one in our countries. And Emmanuel, you mentioned that there is in Ghana. But could you speak a bit to that and how you think about using technology to empower the voices of women in Ghana?
Well, at the back stage, I mentioned that we have technology gap in Ghana. Most women use mobile phone because of illiteracy. They just use mobile phone to receive calls or use it to receive what we call mobile money when their children send them money through the use of mobile phone. As to whether they send you a message, they cannot do it because they are not educated. The gap is there for women. But on the other hand, there's this one of my committee member who uses mobile telephone text messaging to all his constituents, as many people that she knows and have their telephone numbers. She sends them daily messages as to what she's doing in Parliament. I believe that if we leaders, especially political leaders, can educate and also broaden the scope of education so that women can be educated, that will help go a long way to help getting our women to use telephony or telecommunication. In Ghana, it is difficult, pretty difficult, because the gap, the educational gap is quite high.
The gap is also present in politics. It's about attitude. There are less women engineers, mathematicians, physicists, but there are not enough in any society. But that's about the attitude that we women carry with ourselves. I know that when a woman enters political party, she always asks, "What shall I do?" When a man enters political party, he asks, "What shall I be?" Because, you know, he's a politician. He has to be something. And that's something what we were taught as little boys and girls. And I think that internet, social media, a lot of space on internet are also there to encourage girls to be engineers, to be mathematicians, to be whatever she wants to be, because she can't be. I mean, there is a sentence familiar in this country. She can do it. I can do it. We can do it if we want to. That's the point.
There's been research done in the U.S. that a woman needs to be asked 5 times before she'll consider running for political office, whereas a man doesn't have to be asked at all. So there are definitely ways in which creative organizations are thinking about using social media and technology to involve more women in the political process specifically.
Having role models.
Yeah. I'm not talking about a gender gap using technologies in Tunisia, especially since, as I said, we have 42% of internet users who are women. But the real gap exists between urban women and rural women, who are not really, enjoying their rights. They are not aware about their rights. They don't have this access, as Emmanuel said, to technology. And who, even if they got a decent education because of our educational system that has been established since the independence, the social context and the cultural context, they cannot, according to this context, talk about their rights and will to use these technological tools. Even if they use it, well, for example, they use Facebook with a fake account or something like that in order to not to let their families know that they are already using Facebook. And because, as, let's say, an Arab and a Muslim society, we still think that most of the population thinks that Facebook is a kind of dating site. So for them, maybe it would be great if their son uses Facebook, but it would be horrible and terrible if their daughter has an account. And this is the sad reality in our rural areas. The real gap is also exists with those urban women, as I said, who are signing petitions on the internet and who are organizing manifestations and who are going on trips to have trip studies about democracy, about human rights, and who are running hundreds of NGOs, feminist NGOs, and who are supported also by their husbands and who are living in the capital and who are engineers and mathematicians and entrepreneurs and businesswomen. So this is a real gap. And I think that we have to work as politicians in collaboration also with civil society. And I have a project that will be launched very soon in Tunisia about this gap, on empowering those rural women, because they have really good potential and they want to be in politics. And I meet them sometimes in some political meetings, like those public meetings in interior regions, and they are just afraid of getting involved because it's always bad seen to be a leader in politics and to go to this party, political party office, and meet to men and all that stuff. So I think this is the real challenge for us. And maybe we will kind of doing some training for this woman with the civil society and with the parliament also, because as MPs, we are responsible of those women. And in our constitution, we are not only MPs representing our constituencies, but we are MPs in the name of all the Tunisian people. So this is our role, this is our mission, and I hope we can do something in this case.
Just a very quick reaction to what Bezra was saying, because I think it raises the fundamental issue, actually two issues: education, which is probably most probable reason for the gap, except for some cultures where women online is kind of culturally or religiously prohibited, but that's really marginal. I would say it's more education that is the one of the major reasons for this gap. And the other one will be the poverty, which is not the best friend for technology, because people simply do not have an access, because this is still a comfort tool for them, and they cannot allow themselves to have those technologies. And here we come to the basics. As much as we advance technologically, we still are at the basics, that we need to raise literacy rates of our population, we need to tackle poverty, we need to work for the education. Otherwise, these two worlds will be, the gap between the two worlds will be even bigger and bigger than we have it today, that you will have Silicon Valley and people followers of Silicon Valley, and then you have huge number of the population having no idea what is going on in that other world, which is not accessible for them.
We have a stack of questions here from the audience. I think we'll have to set up an online chat to cover all of them, but let's start with a couple while we have a few minutes left. So one is, what's a surprising lesson you've learned about how technology can be used in politics? Something that might surprise the audience.
Then, before the campaign, election campaign, I got friends on Facebook from the circle of friends of my kids. And that was the most surprising message that I've got from them during all my political life. They said, if my own kids would ever express any discontent with me being their mother, they will adopt me. That was...
uh,
I think every mother wants to get that message from her daughter's friends.
Well, I have a page, an online page for my committee, and I expected citizens to engage us solely on what we are doing as a committee. But unfortunately, you get messages coming either from Twitter or from WhatsApp or from all the platforms, some asking questions that are not supposed to be asked on that platform. And the first time we started, we inaugurated a platform, I was amazed of the questions that came out from citizens. And it was like, we've opened the floodgate too much. And if you are not careful, we will not catch up with them. One of the questions was about access to information bill in my country. We are about to pass that law. Unfortunately, we haven't passed it yet. And my committee is basically supposed to pursue ministers as to promises that they have made. Now, this Access to Information Act or bill was brought to Parliament by the government, not by any minister. So my question is that it should just be limited to what my committee is supposed to do. Today, as I sit here, I have 1,001 questions coming from citizens not related to my committee, but from citizens wanting to know one thing or the other that a government concerning the nation wants to do. One of them is our light off. We have huge energy problem crisis in Ghana now. And my site, the committee site, is undated with questions about when will government fix the light. That is not my thing, but it is coming.
Well, the most surprising for me is very personal. It has nothing to do with politics. Every time I have an issue with my kids, they start sending me on Facebook Messenger messages saying that, oh, Mom, we know you are angry on us, but you respond to everybody even if they say you are such a horrible politician. So here is the question we have for you. So that's how we communicate in the modern world. Next, they live in the next room, and they send me messages through Facebook that, oh, you, Mom, you know, I mean, this is what we want from you. That's how it wants to be heard back there sometimes.
The most surprising thing is that having Mom and Dad active on Facebook after integrating politics. So this is the first thing. So actually they have joined Facebook and they are following everything, and they are just reporting to me, because sometimes I just can't find time when I'm in the parliament or in meetings. They are reporting to me each new news about politics and all that stuff. And it's very dynamic in Tunisia. We are, well, almost we have each 2 days new political combination, let's say. And so they are following all those news, and someone said, and the other one replied, and I don't know what. So they are always connected, and sometimes they are on the same couch in the living room, and they are talking with Messenger to each other. And, well, I found this just quite romantic, you know. Romance in the digital age. The second thing is that, it may not be surprising for you, but it was really surprising for me as a sarcastic blogger in Tunisia. So I used to, let's say, to laugh on all the politicians, even my leaders in the party. And I was writing usually sarcastic news and comments and other stuff, especially live when some TV shows were diffused. And since I am an MP, I figured out that I have to do some auto-censorship, and that when my friends started telling me, well, be careful, you can't write the way you are used to write, and you can do this thing, and you can reply on everybody, and you have to say this and this and this, and this is still surprising. So that's why I'm saying that I'm not used to be in a ruling party or to be in an official position, but I'm trying to get used to.
All right. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for only one last question. So I'm going to ask each of you to briefly answer the following. Given that most of you have backgrounds in civil society and political activism before being in government, how do you maintain that spirit amidst the political pressures of your current roles? And if you can do that in a minute or less each.
Well, I have just one sentence to say. As I've said, my political life started as a fairy tale of once upon a time there was this kingdom of evil that we were fighting against, and unfortunately there is no ever after yet. This kingdom is still there fighting against my country, so I'm still there. It still inspires me and makes me being pushing and being there where I am, as long as it's not gone and my country is not out from this space, free, independent, real state. Before that, there is an inspiration.
Well, it is difficult to maintain your soul, you know, life as well as that of the political life. For us back at home, it's quite difficult because, one, they expect you to be the father of everything. You are supposed to be the Father Christmas, the Mother Christmas. You're supposed to deliver every goods and services to whoever vote or not vote for you. And at the same time, they expect you to give back to society. You come into politics thinking that you want to deliver. You have the passion to serve. But only to get there and realize that the burden, the pressure on you is so huge back at home. It's not like in the Western world where everything is down, everything is well structured. You have to go through all kinds of things to be able to survive. So it is difficult for us from Africa.
On the other hand, it's quite simple. You know, there are always a simple answer on a very complicated questions like, how do I lose weight? Don't eat. Simple as that. So, how do you keep up your connections and stay in your mind what you have been 10, 15, or 25 years ago? You make up your mind and decision and don't change your habits. And don't never forget, politics is all about people. And any politician who starts to think that he or she is something better than people who she or she represents, already lost, but also the people lost. So you stick to the principles, you stick what you believe in, and you check all the time with a simple question: have I changed? Have I changed? Would you vote for me again? And listen to what people answer. And that's the fitness for staying fresh in politics.
In Tunisia, again, it's really going very fast, and things are really changing every day, as I said. So one of the funniest things that I've experienced, 2 days after my election, I was really, let's say, tired of telephones and using Facebook, and I've missed 5 or 10 calls. For 2 hours I was sleeping, and I had received 3 text messages from volunteers during the campaign saying, you already don't answer to your voters. And
welcome to the club.
This kind of, let's say, of bad faith on us politicians. Well, come on. I'm just going to say that I totally agree with Gordana. You just don't have to change. We keep. I'm personally keeping my same habits. I have the same friends, even if I disagree with them, even if they are opponents to the government, and even if I am inside the system, as they say. And I'm trying to keep also my, let's say, my simplest habits, like going to the cafe on the corner, to having breakfast with friends, or going to watch a movie, or having a walk, and talk with neighbors. So these kind of simple things let you, in addition to direct contact with voters, in very close to people, and it shows to them that you did not change. And also, well, right now I have to answer all my phone calls, you know. So, well, it's a little bit tiring sometimes, and also I have to answer all the Facebook messages and all tweets and all that stuff. But As I said, sometimes there are some friends, close friends, who are saying to me, well, you have to stop doing this and to behavior like a normal MP or a normal responsible, but I just can't change, and this is me, and this is what's make me close to those people who voted for me.
So on that note, thank you very much to our panelists, the Honorable Tinatin Kidashili, member of the Parliament of Georgia, the Honorable Emmanuel Kwasi Bezra, member of Ghana's Parliament, the Honorable Gordana Chomic, member of the Serbian National Assembly, and the Honorable Sabrine Gubantini, member of the Tunisian Assembly of People's Representatives. We want to thank as well our audience here and on radio, television, and the internet. This program has been held in association with the National Democratic Institute and the Institute for Representative Government, and is part of an exchange program supported by the U.S. State Department and the U.S. Agency for Development on Leadership in the Digital Economy. I'm Stacey Donahue, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.